This is the Cider Guide Podcast. I'm your host, Eric West. Each episode, I sit down to chat with a personality from the wide world of cider. Past guests have included Tom Oliver of Oliver Cider & Perry, Nicole Laban of Farnham Hill Ciders, and Andy Brennan of Aaron Burr Cider. Please visit ciderguide.com/podcast for a listing of past episodes, transcripts, RSS feeds, and other useful information. That's ciderguide.com/podcast. Joining me for episode 7 is Alan Shapiro of SBS Imports. Alan organizes the highly successful Cider Summit festivals in Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Chicago, and the San Francisco Bay Area. Much of our conversation focuses on the past, present, and future of the Cider Summit festivals, but Alan also has much to say about how he sees the cider industry evolving, informed by his decades of experience in the alcoholic beverage industry. For example, Alan was influential in the early days of Pete's Wicked Ale, one of America's first craft beer brands, and he was also one of the first to import English cider to the United States, when in 2003 he began bringing Aspel ciders from Suffolk, England across the Atlantic. This interview, it's fairly short, but I think it's packed with interesting tidbits of cider information. Here's my conversation with Alan Shapiro.
With me today, I have Alan Shapiro of SBS Imports. Alan is best known in the world of cider as the impresario behind the wildly successful Cider Summit Festival. Alan, thanks for joining me today.
Eric, thanks very much for asking me to be on. Appreciate it.
Alan, I know that you have a really deep background in the beverage world, particularly with craft beer and with high-end imported beer, but let's talk about the Cider Summit first, because I think that's where people know you from. So you launched the first Cider Summit in Seattle in 2010, is that right?
Correct.
And what led you to believe at the time, because now you kind of look like a genius now that the cider category is exploding, but what led you to believe at the time that a cider-only tasting festival would ever be successful?
Well, a couple of years prior to that, 2007 or 2008, I was having lunch down in the Bay Area with a co-founder of Pete's Brewing Company, Pete's Wicked Ale, which I worked at in 89 and 90. And the gentleman's name is Mark Bronder. And Mark was kind of quizzing me about the world of cider. He certainly knew a little bit about craft beer, but just didn't know what was out there in terms of the cider world. And Mark's the kind of guy who's very insightful and inquisitive, and if he met you, he would find out what you did, and he'd ask you 10 or 12 great questions, and he'd understand it, and he'd have great recommendations for you. And so as I described what was happening in the world of cider, and this is said in 2007, 2008, he said, you know, it sounds an awful lot like the late 80s when we were trying to get Pete's Wicked Ale going. And people were just didn't understand what was in the bottle, why a beer would be brown, what dry hop meant, and any of those kind of basic things, let alone the outrageous price of $5.99 a six-pack at the time.
Right.
And so, you know, he said that one of the big things that he felt helped was, you know, a couple weekends a month, they were at some community festival or fair, pouring samples and converting people, you know, consumer by consumer, and explaining, you know, why the beer was brown and what hops were in the beer. And he said, you know, I think maybe that's what you need to do with cider, is get people past the mystery of this burgeoning category and give them an opportunity to try these things without having to spend a bunch of money on each bottle. And he said, if I was you, I'd create a cider festival, and I bet you're going to help build the category if you do.
You must have had pretty modest expectations then at first, I guess, because if you were looking at it as sort of an educational type thing, surely you didn't think it was going to grow the way that it's grown.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't know if anyone would show up. So we had maybe, not even 500 people at our first event in Seattle in 2010. And our fifth event, which just took place a couple of months ago, that number grew to the area of 4,000.
That's impressive growth.
We felt after the first one, if we could maybe grow it to 1,000 people, we could maybe figure out how to not lose a bunch of money. And that it would just be kind of a nice, enjoyable event. And so it turns out my friend Mark was right on target with his advice. And from there, we added Portland in 2011, Chicago in 2013, and earlier this year we had our first Bay Area event.
That's excellent. So with that first, I guess with the first events in Seattle and Portland, I guess the first event for all four, how were you able to kind of reach out to the cider makers? Like, how were you able to kind of make contacts? Because it seems like, you know, the cider producers are spread out all over the country. They have fairly small distribution, if any. How did you bring the kind of the producers together and encourage them to join this festival?
Well, we try to have a regional focus on each event. I had been living in Seattle, had been pretty active in trying to just build the category locally, as I was the importer of Aspel ciders from Suffolk, England, dating back to 2003. And so, you know, the limited number of cider makers that were in the Northwest region kind of all knew each other at this point, and the Northwest Cider Association was reforming. And so they've been a really good partner for us to work with in our two events out here. But the truth is we struggled to put together enough selection in that first year. I think maybe we had at best a dozen different cider companies and somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 45 ciders. And with our, you know, events now, for example, in Chicago, we'll probably have 42 vendors in the neighborhood of 150 to 160 different ciders. And that's limiting the number that each company can bring.
That's exciting. I think as we talked about before, I've never actually been to a cider summit. As excited as I am about the cider category and as much as I've researched it, I've never actually been to one. And I suspect that many of my listeners haven't either. Can you talk a little bit about the format? Because I think people who are listening have probably been maybe to a beer festivals or wine festivals, but, you know, what roughly do these cost to get in? How do people sample? Like, if someone was to go to a cider summit, let's say they're going to go to Cider Summit Chicago, what could they expect from that event?
People can, we've got online ticketing for Chicago. We do walk-ups and a combination of advance online in our other cities. But people will pay $30. They will get a souvenir 4-ounce tasting glass. We're doing something that's kind of like a mini Belgian goblet this year for Chicago. And they'll get 8 tasting tickets. Of the roughly 150 ciders that will be there, probably 90% of those will be one tasting ticket for the 4-ounce sample. There's a few things like ice ciders and some other exotic things that are just more expensive or higher alcohol, and so we pour those in smaller sample sizes. And the event in format is, you know, not dissimilar from a beer festival or a wine tasting. I consider it kind of a hybrid of those. So you will have primarily around the perimeter of the room, you know, 42 cider vendor tables, each typically pouring 2 to 4 different styles. And the tables are, it's the actual cider makers at the tables in almost all the cases, or the importers in some cases. And so you'll be able to meet the cider makers and hopefully have a chance to get the real inside info and ask some questions and get educated and try a vast range of styles and types of cider. We have some food accompaniments, typically kind of a chocolate sampler, a cheese sampler, maybe a charcuterie plate from some great regional vendors. And then there'll be an opportunity to interact with a couple of the local or regional cider associations, as well as the National U.S. Cider Makers Association, and talk to those people about legislation and what they do and what's on the horizon for cider in each of those areas.
Excellent. So we also talked a little bit before we started recording about the indoor versus outdoor nature of the event. So Chicago, obviously being during the winter, you would want to have indoors. But what about the events that you do in the San Francisco Bay Area and Portland and Seattle? You know, can people bring their dogs? Can people, because I'm thinking like summer, you know. What sort of features besides the things you just mentioned would kind of attract somebody to want to come out for the day?
Sure. A couple, you know, big differences. Obviously, we put the Chicago event in February to coincide with the annual cider conference. And so that gives us an opportunity to really have a wider array of cider makers. geographically, as nearly the whole industry is there. So we're able to have more East Coast and West Coast producers, as well as a central region, a nice mix of cider makers from France and Spain and Germany this year, Scotland, England, of course. And in Chicago, we do that in four-hour sessions, two in the same day. So one is 11 to 3. We have a one-hour break, and session two is 4 to 8. Our West Coast events are outdoor events, and they're usually in nice parks with grass and trees, and they follow generally the same format. But one of the most popular features that we have at our outdoor events is that we've always allowed people to bring their behaved dogs. And in fact, we have an area we call the Dog Lounge, which is usually run by a local pet shelter or other pet charity. And dogs can get some water and refresh and recharge and mingle with other dogs that are there and kind of have a nice social break with other pet owners.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Have I also read that at some of the events that attendees can purchase bottles to go? Is that correct?
Yes, and that's a state-by-state situation, both in Oregon and Washington. That's possible. It just has to do with the local rules by the governing liquor commission. So we have an event store on site where in most of, at those two events, we can do bottles to go. We also have T-shirts. We added growler sales to go as well. And if people want some extra tasting tickets, they can buy them there. And also, we typically will have some shopping bags or some of the cider books as well. So it's the Bottles to Go store has been very popular because people come to the event, get to, taste this huge variety of products, and a number of them have pretty limited distribution, of course. So they can pick them up right then and there.
That sounds like a really nice kind of bonus there. I would certainly bring some extra cash, I guess. Or do you accept credit cards at those events?
We accept credit cards, yes.
Okay, so bring your credit card and bring home some cider with you. That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, Alan, let's switch gears for a little bit. I want to come back to cider, obviously, but you do have a really long veteran sort of background in the beer world. I don't know if you've read this book, but I recently read the book by Steve Hindy of the Brooklyn Brewery called The Craft Beer Revolution, and I was kind of reading that book in mind with trying to see some parallels between the way that sort of beer has developed in the United States and maybe thinking about how cider would develop. For example, mm-hmm. in the book, he mentions how in the beginning, maybe back sort of like in the 80s, early 90s, there were a lot of different business models that brewers were trying out, just brew pubs, doing everything yourself, contract brewing. And, we're starting to see some different models with cider as well. For example, you have everything from sort of the orchard-based estate bottle, Farnham Hill, for example, maybe, all the way through the spectrum to maybe like contract production, total contract production, like maybe Original Sin, which is actually based in Manhattan, where there are no orchards. So I was just kind of interested in your thoughts on how you see the cider industry evolving, and does it even really make sense to use the rise of craft beer and specially imported beer as a point of reference to think about cider?
I think there are a number of parallels. I am fortunately or unfortunately old enough to also to remember when kind of wine hit its stride in the U.S. about a decade or so before specialty beer. So I think some of the similarities are that we're at a stage in these last few years where people are first learning to discover there are different types and styles of cider. Much like those kind of early days I described at Peach Brewing, where no one knew what a brown ale was or a beer could even be that color. And then as the consumer is becoming more educated, I think they're able to distinguish a bit more about the different range of cider kind of producers. And I think that you have certain segments of the cider category right now that are drawing in a lot of specialty beer consumers, and they at this point may be drawn more to some of the flavored ciders and spice ciders and kind of experimental things. I see that quite a bit here on the West Coast. I think you have some consumers that we're drawing from the wine world, and they're probably going to be more interested in the things like Farnham Hill or Easy Orchards in Oregon is another great example of really, you know, terrific orchard-based artisan production that's in more of a wine feel, you know, cork finish 750 ml bottles. And so there's starting to be some segmentation developing, I think, within the cider universe, and there's going to be some evolution on the consumer side in terms of some percentage of them getting really interested and feeling that it's important that they're drinking an orchard-based cider. But that's still a relatively small percentage. But another beer analogy might be in the Belgian category. 10 years ago, you had very, very few people, say, interested in lambic, because most found it undrinkable. But now we're at a point where there's really a shortage of it in the market. And in fact, a lot of, you know, the geekiest beer consumers feel almost the more undrinkable, the better. And I'm not suggesting our top 10 ciders like a Farnham Hill are undrinkable, but I think there is, it takes some palate development to get to wanting to consume that on a consistent basis. And, you know, on a wine analogy you had, when I started my career there, it was largely kind of jug wines and wine coolers. And really the breakthrough product in the wine category in the kind of late 70s, early 80s was actually White Zinfandel. And that was a product that got people purchasing a 750 ml bottle for the first time and just brought a huge array of consumers into drinking wine. Which at the time was very, you know, very elite kind of beverage. And so there's obviously been a huge evolution of that over the last, you know, 20, 30 years.
So it sounds like with regard to the different sort of cider segments, I guess most people are kind of remaining agnostic as opposed to preferring the orchard-based stuff over something else just because different people of different ages and different backgrounds can enter the cider category in many different sort of points of entry. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's, you know, we're still in the very early days of people's understanding of the segmentation of the cider category, and most of them probably don't care that much about, you know, that kind of inside pool. What we do find at the festivals is, you know, probably 80% of our attendees are just, I call them cider curious. You know, they've kind of heard cider's getting more and more popular now, and they just want to go and try some things, which was a big part of the original vision of the festival. And maybe 15 or 20%, you know, are much more educated cider people, and they want to go to the orchard-based brands, and they want to talk to the cider maker, and they want to, you know, ask very specific questions about the apples and the process. And again, that's not a whole lot different than beer festivals were in 1990.
Right. So you mentioned a little earlier that you began importing Aspel ciders to the U.S. in 2003. What appealed to you about Aspel, and why did you choose it to your portfolio?
It was honestly a fluke. I really was uneducated myself in about what cider was. I had, early in my career with Seagram's, had sold wine coolers for a living, and I kind of thought of cider in that same category at the time. An old colleague from my days at Seagram was working for an organization called Foods from Britain, and he had heard I was looking at starting a new importing company, and this was in 2002. And he suggested I visit Aspel, who was looking to bring their brand to the U.S., and, you know, I frankly told him I'm not interested in looking at cider. He said, no. You know, this is something different from what you've had before. So I was going to be in the area and agreed to at least have a courtesy meeting, and fully expecting to go and say, thank you for a very nice day, but I have no interest in cider. And I visited, you know, their 300-acre orchard estate, dating back to 1728 on a beautiful summer day, the two brothers, Henry and Barry Chevalier Guild, were of similar age and terrific people. And I saw the beautiful bottle they had, and I tasted their dry cider. And people with a better vocabulary would call it their epiphany moment. I just kind of call it my wow moment. It reminded me of when I had my first good glass of wine after drinking the jug stuff, or my first really good beer after drinking, you know, the garbagey stuff. And I felt like the light bulb literally went on over my head and said, okay, I get it. And I think there's something here. And so I kind of accidentally stumbled upon it, brought it to the U.S. in the spring of 2003. And we, you know, I think have been a good partner in helping develop the cider category in those early days.
Yeah, I recently met Henry at Cider Week New York City. He is very knowledgeable about the cider traditions of England and seems to be, I guess, kind of an ambassador, I guess, for cider in general. He seems just to be very, very interested in the U.S., what's happening in the U.S., and I think his ciders are being fairly well received here.
Yes, I was pleasantly surprised, really, by how well we did so soon. And they've been, Henry and his brother Barry have been terrific partners to work with. And, you know, Henry's really right out of central casting for someone you want to be a spokesperson for English cider.
Yeah. Well, I remember, actually, I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area in 2003, and I remember purchasing at least one or two bottles of Aspel cider then. And for me, it wasn't quite a light bulb moment. And I think the reason why was because I had it, and I think I liked it, but there wasn't really anything else on the shelf to try and compare it to. So I think it's exciting now that, you know, you go to any good bottle shop and, you know, Aspel is not going to be the only cider there. So you kind of have a point of reference and you can kind of sample the different styles. I think that's pretty exciting.
Yes, and it's just, and that's part of the opportunity people get at the Cider Summit festivals is, you know, it may be, you know, whatever large brand they've tried in a bar that kind of got them tasting their first cider. But, you know, more often than not, they're at the festival to experiment a bit and really broaden their palates and their horizons on Saturday on cider category. And, you know, so that creates, you know, opportunities for many, many brands to, you know, just get some hands-on marketing contact with the consumer, which, again, was a big part of the design of Cider Summit festivals.
Actually, one thing that intrigues me talking about Aspel is that I'm a really huge supporter of, you know, small-scale cider makers, any cider makers in North America, but it seems that many of the European nations, England, France, Spain, Germany, Austria, they have pretty mature cider industries, and they may have sort of limited potential for growth domestically. But I suspect that there's a lot of potential Aspels over there in Europe who are maybe looking at the U.S. and Canada as an important export market for them. What's your sort of take on that, and how does that process work? Like, how, you know, would somebody in Europe make contact in the U.S., and how would they actually get their brands brought over here? Because some people are not really clear on the whole sort of legal process and the business side of things. So could you talk a little bit about how that works?
Sure, in general. The details of working with the government and importing would get people clicking off your page immediately, I'm sure. But what will typically happen is cider makers from Europe or other parts of the world will either source information on U.S. importers from the Internet, or they might be attending the cider conference, for example, hoping to meet them. And so each importer kind of has their own criteria for brands, you know, they might be interested in working with and how they select those. It could be, you know, types of apples used in taste profile. It could be packaging. It could be willingness for the cider makers in Europe to come to the country to support the brands. It could simply be, you know, pricing. And so anyways, once those kind of details are worked out, there'll be a U.S. importer who's responsible for bringing the product to this country, and then in turn will sell it to their distribution network throughout the country, and then in turn they, you know, hopefully sell it to lots of stores and bars and restaurants across the country. That's kind of the quick snapshot of the three-tier system as it's known as here.
Yeah, and do you see a lot of potential growth for that market?
I think there's going to be more and more. Quite often, both from my beer days before and wine days and insiders, many, you know, brands look at the U.S. as the land of opportunity because of the sheer size of the marketplace here. But I think, you know, there's obviously been a proliferation of cider brands and cideries opening over the last several years. And so I think that, much like what's happening in the specialty beer business right now, is, you know, you need to have some authenticity, some unique, you know, the marketing guys call it the USPs, a unique selling proposition. You know, what will make your brand stand out on the shelf or on the pub list? And, you know, and of course, quality is going to have to be the baseline for that. But there's going to have to be something a little bit more to engage the consumer, I think.
So it all kind of comes back to that education piece that you were trying to do with the first Cider Summits.
That's a big part of it. And I think, you know, part of what drew me to Aspel was they had some very elegant packaging. They had a range of taste profiles that weren't necessarily in this market yet in 2003. So I thought they had some things that would, you know, capture the consumer's interest.
Well, Alan, I know that event management and promotion can be pretty stressful and exhausting, but are you considering possibly expanding your Cider Summit empire to other cities? Do you even have time?
It's my crew might kill me if we went too far with it, but you know, it's something that we constantly talk about, and people ask us in every corner of the country. Because certainly there's going to be more and more cider festivals happening out there, and there's more and more interest, you know, in cider from really all parts of the country. So we haven't committed to any new cities yet, but we're trying to figure out if and how we could do it, and just not sure.
Well, if people want to learn more about the Cider Summits and possibly find out about potential other locations, where should they go online to learn more?
So the best thing is to cidersummit.com, and there's a little entry where you can click on the cities that are coming up next. So this part that's active right now is Chicago, and advanced ticket sales are online and active right now. And as we get through Chicago, we will have info online about our next event, which will be in the Bay Area at the end of April. And then we also have a Cider Summit page on Facebook and a Cider Summit Twitter account where people can get probably even more frequent updates.
Excellent. So the next Cider Summit is Cider Summit Chicago on February 7th, 2015. I'm very much excited. Like I said, it's going to be my first Cider Summit, and Alan, I look forward to seeing you there.
I am looking forward to seeing you there as well, Eric, and thanks very much for allowing us the few minutes to talk about the Cider Summit.
I really enjoyed learning more about the Cider Summits, as well as hearing Alan's opinions about the future of cider in the U.S. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, too. That wraps up Episode 7. Visit ciderguide.com/7. That's CIDERGUIDE.com/7 to read the episode transcript, which includes links to items mentioned during this interview. And if you'd like to download more episodes or find out more about the podcast in general, that's ciderguide.com/podcast. CIDERGUIDE.com/podcast. I also highly suggest that wherever you find this podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, at my website, wherever, take a minute to leave a rating or a review. It really does help other cider enthusiasts find the podcast and encourages them to become regular listeners. I value you as a listener, and if the podcast is meaningful to you, please spread the word to others who might enjoy it just as much as you do. And before I go, let me share with you a few specific reviews that have been posted to iTunes. From listener Illustrious El Jefe, Eric West brings in the big guns from many different facets of cider. From fifth-generation growers to the people who write books, the podcast brings in some of the leaders of the cider industry. Each individual who talks on the podcast brings insight and experience. For someone who has really become interested over the past few years, hearing the movers and shakers explain their thoughts on apples and cider is fascinating as well as inspiring. Awesome. And from listener Mass DW, clean, simple interviews with great guests. Please keep them coming. Consider Henry Chevalier Guild for one. So thank you for the praise. And if you'd like to hear more from Henry Chevalier Guild of Aspel, Henry and I were actually both guests on episode 240 of Beer Sessions Radio out of New York City. That airs on the Heritage Radio Network, so if you visit heritageradionetwork.org, Click on the Beer Sessions radio logo and then scroll through the past episodes list until you found the one titled Episode 240, Cider Sessions, Past, Present, and Future of Cider. All right, I'm done. If you'd like to send me your feedback, I'm at CiderGuide on Twitter, or you can email me directly at eric@ciderguide.com. That's eric@ciderguide.com. Thank you for listening.